It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Wisconsin's bats are under threat from white nose syndrome, a disease that spread to 14 Wisconsin counties in the last 3 years. We find out why it's so deadly and what fewer bats would mean for the state. Now, for the first time, the Wisconsin Department of Justice has formalized its guidelines for investigating fatal police shootings. The new guidelines are the latest step in the state's effort to be a national leader on that issue. Jason Stein joins us now. He's a state capitol reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Jason, welcome back.
Hello, Veronica. Thanks for having me.
Well, Jason, how significant are these guidelines in the nationwide, really, response to the turmoil over police shootings?
Sure. Well, first of all, Wisconsin is one of the few states where every police shooting or suspect that dies in police custody, where an independent investigation has got to be a run of that. And, you know, just in the lead up to this segment, you were talking about the shooting in Appleton over the weekend, and that is being investigated by the Green Bay Police Department. So these are guidelines that outside agencies like the Green Bay Police Department can lean on as they try and conduct these independent reviews of shootings and, you know, other use of deadly force by police.
Well, Wisconsin already has to have an independent investigation of police shootings. Now we have these guidelines. So what was in place before that?
Well, you know, interestingly, for 3 years now, the State Department of Justice has been conducting these investigations without a formal written policy on police shootings. Now, they have written policies for just in general for investigations, and they had some unwritten understandings about how to handle these specific cases, but they finally put forward about a 20-page guidebook that is designed to give some protocols and policies for their agents, their Division of Criminal Investigation agents, you know, when they roll into, you know, under very sudden circumstances in most cases, a shooting, you know, that might happen in a small community or a city as large as Milwaukee.
Now, before we get into what's in the guidelines, more of the specifics, can you tell us a little bit about the creation of them and how they came to be?
Well, in 2014, there was legislation passed putting forward this, in, you know, mandating this independent investigation in Wisconsin of police shootings. And, you know, the Department of Justice has been the lead agency in doing those. Sometimes they are done by another police department. For instance, my understanding is that Appleton and Green Bay trade off in some of those investigations, but really it's the Department of Justice that's done the most of them, and they're drawing on the lessons that they've learned from dozens of these incidents around the state.
Well, Jason, can you tell us a little bit about what's in them? What are the highlights that stand out to you?
Sure. I mean, you know, some of these things are as basic as how they will roll out news about these events to the media and to the public. You know, many of them are non-controversial items. But, you know, there have been some things that have drawn public debate. For instance, there was a shooting in Neenah in December of 2015. And, you know, in subsequent to that, Department of Justice agents used, you know, used a policy, showed the officers had shot a hostage rather than the hostage taker in that situation, showed them video of the incident prior to interviewing them. And, you know, that sparked debate that showed up in newspapers, including mine. And, you know, one of the things that they have done is, since then, is change their policy to say that, it, you know, in most circumstances, officers will not be shown those videos of what happened prior to being interviewed about what happened.
And I understand that at least one of the rules was also in response to the police shooting of Madison's Tony Robinson. Can you tell us about that one?
Correct. So in that case, that was an unarmed teenager who was shot in Madison. And again, in that case, the officer, Kinney, who shot Tony Robinson, was allowed to see video from that incident that showed some of the shots fired prior to being interviewed by Department of Justice investigators. You know, going forward, that would not happen. It would only happen if a police officer insisted on seeing the video prior to being interviewed. And even in that situation, the local district attorney who would have to make any charging decision based on the investigation, he or she would have to sign off on showing the video before it would happen.
Jason Stein is with us right now, State Capitol reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. And he's with us to talk about new guidelines for investigating fatal police shootings from the Wisconsin Department of Justice. And Jason, I understand there's also more specificity now about what the point of the investigation might be, and that is the officer to be charged with a crime or not, and that can't be used for other purposes.
Right. So, I mean, one example was, again, in the Tony Robinson case. In that case, the Madison Police Department, relied on the state investigator's interview of Officer Kinney when deciding whether or not to discipline him, right? So two things happen when there's an officer-involved shooting. One, the district attorney needs to make a decision about whether there was any, you know, criminal culpability on the part of the officer, which, in the great majority of cases, that is not the case. But then also the individual police agency has got to conduct its own internal investigation about whether or not, you know, the officer violated any just departmental rules and, you know, whether or not there would be any discipline of the officer. And what the state DOJ is now saying explicitly is that they're not going to be let those criminal interviews be used for discipline of officers, that, in other words, the local police agency is going to have to do its own work and its own interview as it comes to that determination.
And Jason, as we start to wrap up, what are people saying outside the state and in the state about these guidelines and whether or not this could make Wisconsin a leader?
Sure. You know, we have seen some voices from outside the state point to Wisconsin's model as a possible path forward for the nation on this, including the criminal law program at Stanford recently put out a report that cited Wisconsin as a model. You know, at the same time, there also continues to be some criticism about the way we do things here. For instance, these rules don't explicitly prohibit an officer, a DCI agent or another investigator, from looking into a shooting that happened within his or her former employer. So a city of Milwaukee investigator goes to the state, he or she could potentially investigate a shooting in Milwaukee. And, you know, that's something that some people have called for change on.
Jason, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure, Veronica.
That was Jason Stein from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel joining us to take a look at new guidelines for investigating fatal police shootings that came from the Wisconsin Department of Justice. Right now, Wisconsin's bat population is under threat from white nose syndrome. New research from the State Department of Natural Resources found that in some caves, they killed up to 60% of hibernating bats this winter. Scientists are trying to find out more about why some bats survive the disease and if there's a way to slow the spread. Dave Bleihert is with us from the U.S. Geological Survey's National Wildlife Health Center. Kate Archer-Kent talked with him last week.
The DNR said in its most recent survey of bat hibernation sites in Wisconsin that the death toll from white nose syndrome is catastrophic. What is this disease and how deadly is it to our cave-dwelling bats here in Wisconsin?
The disease is caused by a fungus. The fungus's name is Pseudogymnoascus destructans. I know that's a mouthful.
Yeah.
Our thought is that the fungus, or evidence suggests that the fungus was introduced to North America from Eurasia, where it's likely existed for a long time. Hibernating bat species of North America were previously naive to the fungus, and it's proven to be quite a deadly pathogen. The disease first emerged in the northeastern United States, in New York, and has since spread extensively throughout the eastern half of the country, with an unexpected jump last year, about 1 year ago, to Washington State. And unfortunately, we've seen that once the disease or the fungus enters a susceptible hibernating bat population, it can exert initial mortality up to 100% of that colony.
What is the status of our bat population here in Wisconsin?
So the disease was first detected a couple of years ago in Wisconsin, and initially we can when we monitor for disease at the leading edge of the region where the disease is known to exist, first we'll find low levels of the pathogenic fungus in bats. Then the next year we'll start to see signs of disease in bats and low-level mortality, and our thought is that as the fungus has several years to amplify in bats and in their hibernation sites, it reaches levels that it then becomes quite lethal in subsequent years, and that's what we're unfortunately seeing now in the state of Wisconsin.
How exactly does this spread from bat to bat?
So the fungus propagates on the skin of bats, and it can spread from bats just through simple contact among the animals. And when they hibernate, they're quite gregarious. They form large clusters of hibernating animals. Hibernation is interspersed with brief periods where the bats arouse and come out of hibernation, and during those times they move about and have contact with other animals. So it's really a nightmare scenario where you've got high density of susceptible hosts in confined environments conducive to amplification of the pathogen with ready transmission among those animals.
Has this white-nose syndrome spread to other populations? Has it threatened other animal populations?
To date, we've only seen manifestation of disease in hibernating bats. The fungus has some very interesting properties. For example, it's what we call a psychrophile. It can only grow in the cold. So bats are mammals like you and I, and during the spring, fall, and summer, when they're metabolically active and flying around in the night skies eating insects, they have uniformly warm bodies, just like us or our pet dog, our pet cat. When they go into hibernation, they retreat into caves for a period of dormancy. These caves are about the temperature of the inside of a refrigerator, and this fungus can only grow in the cold. The fungus, if you were to put it on the desktop in front of me right now in my office, which I would never do because that would be a breach of biosecurity, it can't grow. It's too warm at 70 degrees Fahrenheit for this fungus to grow. And so its growth and infectious nature is confined to these cold hibernation sites into which bats retreat when they hibernate. And part of the unique physiology of these animals is when they go into this period of winter dormancy, they actually drop their body temperature to something similar to the inside of your refrigerator. And it's that unique metabolic physiologic capability of these animals to reduce their body temperature to conserve energy and effectively go into this state of torpor for the winter that makes them susceptible to the fungus. In effect, it's not unlike that tub of cottage cheese that you may have forgotten in the back of your refrigerator and it gets moldy, because mold spores are ubiquitous in our environment, and unfortunately this new fungus, Pseudogymnoascus destructans, is now one of the airborne mold spores that bats need to now deal with in their hibernation sites.
This fungus then covers the bat's eyes, it covers their nose. What does it look like and feel like, and what is this fungus actually doing to the bat?
So the disease is called white nose syndrome because in many cases we see the fungus growing on the muzzle or the nose of the bats. But the primary site of infection turns out to be their wings. Their wings are unfurred skin. Their bat wings are a very unique organ in that they're exquisitely delicate and complicated. The skin that comprises the wing of a bat comprises up to 85% of the skin area on that entire animal. And in addition to the these wings conferring the unique ability among mammals of flight to bats. They're the only mammals that can fly. It's a very sensitive membrane. And So it represents a very large surface area when these bats are hibernating and not otherwise eating or drinking. Intact wing membrane is critical so that they don't, for example, lose water through their wing membrane at a time of year when they're not drinking. And this fungus is disrupting the integrity of that wing membrane. You can imagine that this wing membrane is highly vascularized, has a lot of blood vessels in mm-hmm. it, in order to keep it perfused with oxygen and viable during that 6 months of the year when the bats are hibernating and their heart rates are greatly reduced. So essentially the fungus is disrupting water balance, circulation, blood pH, many physiological factors that we think are mediated through normal, healthy function of all of the various physiology that needs to be coordinated through this wing.
So the bat is waking up a lot during hibernation?
That's one of the effects. We've seen that that infected bats have increased energy consumption. The fungal infection can drive the bat out of hibernation more frequently than normal, resulting in increased energy usage. The fungus, for reasons we don't necessarily understand, induces odd or unusual abnormal behaviors in the bats, causing them sometimes to exit their hibernacula, their hibernation sites in large numbers during the wintertime when there are no insects on the landscape for them to feed on.
For them to eat, yeah.
Correct. And adverse weather conditions that they're not evolved to survive. So we see bats dying of exposure on the landscape in the wintertime.
We're talking right now with David Bleihert. He is the chief of the Wildlife Disease Diagnostic Laboratories branch of the U.S. Geological Survey's National Wildlife Health Center. We're talking about white nose syndrome, a disease that's killed off millions of bats in North America in recent years and really decimating populations, hitting hard now here in Wisconsin. David, where are you seeing this white nose syndrome have the most devastating effects here in Wisconsin?
So effectively we see the disease behave similarly in sites that harbor hibernating bats with conditions appropriate to propagation of the fungus. I would say the simplest answer to that question is any site that's been infected with the fungus for a couple years that has conducive conditions, which is essentially, unfortunately, all of them, we are seeing consistently severe impacts.
In particular counties? Or you don't break it down that way?
I don't have that information in front of me to break that down that specifically right now.
Sure. So, if we see such a decrease in the bat population, how would it affect us? Why are bats our friends?
Right. So bats are voracious predators of insects. Those insects include mosquitoes. They include plant pests like moths. They include forest pests, also different moths that consume plant tissues. So different modeling studies, for example, have shown that the insects consumed by bats confer billions of dollars a year in pesticides value that farmers don't otherwise have to apply because those insect populations are being kept in check to a degree by bats.
Mm-hmm.
And that work has also been borne out by experimental work where they create large exclosures over cornfields, for example, that exclude bats, and then they can actually measure insect predation on those plants. And so that is one of the areas of concern, that loss of bat predation on insects could require increased use of pesticides. That puts more chemicals in the environment as well as confers increased costs to agriculture.
The DNR has said that it's shifting the focus of its work to finding out why bats at some hibernation sites survive at higher rates than others. Do you have an idea about why that might be and whether this is a good shift to focus on in this research to how to combat this syndrome?
Yeah, that is a very interesting point. We have seen some sites in the Northeast where there are remnant surviving populations. Hopefully from the perspective that it's not all doom and gloom, we've also seen, now that disease has been in the northeastern United States for about a decade, we have seen signs of recovery among some populations. We know that cave hibernating bats do persist across Europe, where the function or where the fungus has presumably been for many, many, many years. So it is likely that these populations will naturally develop some form of resistance to the fungus.
And David, what can we do here on the home front to help stop the spread of white nose syndrome or help the bat population recover? What can we do here in Wisconsin?
Right. One of the biggest challenges to managing this disease is that in addition to the spread of the fungus from bat to bat, the fungus also establishes reservoirs in suitable environments, like in soil of hibernation sites like caves. So in addition to probably the primary means by which the fungus is spread, bat-to-bat interactions, humans moving from one cave to another have the potential to also move infectious spores of the fungus. And that may not be such a big deal within a defined local area where bats are already moving the fungus, but it does become a big deal if that human-mediated movement is, for example, from Europe to the United States, likely the means by which this disease was introduced to this country, or from somewhere in the eastern United States to near Seattle, Washington, as happened last year. And so people should be cautious, especially if they enter cave sites, to follow guidelines put out by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and the State Department of Natural Resources to avoid inadvertently moving the pathogen. Additionally, anything that we can do to support bat habitat and bat conservation, whereas it may not directly be addressing the specific impacts of white nose syndrome, it is still supportive to bat populations in general that need all the help they can get right now.
Well, David, thank you so much for explaining this and being with us today.
Sure, thank you.
That was David Bleihert of the U.S. Geological Survey's National Wildlife Health Center talking about white nose syndrome and Wisconsin's bats population. Political TV is on the rise. Saturday Night Live just earned its highest Nielsen ratings in 24 years. In February, Fox News saw its primetime viewership up 31% from a year ago, and shows like Rachel Maddow and The Colbert Show are spiking in the ratings and seen as a place for the anti-Trump crowd to come together. By contrast, Jimmy Fallon's numbers are falling. Politics aren't exactly Fallon's bread and butter, and by his own account, he still hasn't bounced back from an interview he did back in September. In that interview, Fallon ruffled Trump's hair and was accused of helping to humanize the controversial candidate.
Donald, I want to ask you, because the next time I see you, you could be the president of the United States. I just wanted to know if there's something we could do that's just not presidential, really, or something that we can do now that we're just both civilians. Like,
like what? This is... I'm not liking the sound of this. Go ahead.
Can I mess your hair up?
And we want to hear from you about this. Are you watching more old-fashioned broadcast TV than before the election to get the latest on politics? Or is it maybe because you want catharsis or a place to see your point of view reflected? Maybe just a sense of community? And is all this political TV good for us, or is it just another version of the echo chamber? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Eric Deggans joins us now. He's the TV critic for NPR. Eric, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Eric, in your own words, how would you summarize the trends that we're seeing right now in political TV?
Well, it's interesting because one thing we shouldn't lose sight of is that everybody who is talking about politics and news is seeing their audience go up. Trump makes so much news every day, and the reaction to some of the things he's done and the various investigations and all kinds of permutations of political news coming out of Washington, D.C., we're joking that at 5:30 every day, you know, in our offices, we wait around to see what the story of the day is going to be, because something is bound to happen towards the end of the day that will obliterate anything that came before. And so part of this, I think, is that people are flocking to platforms where they can find out what happened and they can also process what happened. So when I look at Jimmy Fallon, for example, not doing as well in the ratings as Colbert, part of what I think is going on there is that Fallon's not really talking about politics, and when he talks about politics, he does it in a very sort of genial, non-committal kind of way. Isn't Trump silly? Isn't Washington silly? And people are seeing all of these sort of landmark events come out of Washington. They're looking for a way to process that. There's a lot of anxiety. There's a lot of concern. There's a lot of anger. There's a lot of confusion. And Colbert is channeling that, and he is processing that in real time for his audience. And Jimmy's not doing that. And so I don't know if it's necessarily that Colbert is critical of Trump. I think it's more that he's talking about what's happening now, and he's talking about it in a way that's relevant for his audience. And Fallon's not doing that. I would say the same thing about The Daily Show and Seth Meyers' Late Night. And the ultimate beneficiary of this, of course, is Saturday Night Live, which I think has really done a great job of coming up with parodies of White House officials that really get at what we find absurd about them, what we find questionable about them, what we find laughable about them, and then blowing that up into these skits that are really telling about our modern political moment. And that's ultimately what we really demand from the best satire out there.
And you mentioned Stephen Colbert. You see him as someone who's sort of helping process things. He has had a very sharp point of view to the point that the FCC is looking into him. And we have a little clip, a sampling of what viewers have been seeing from Stephen Colbert.
Mr. Trump, your presidency, I love your presidency. I call it disgrace the nation. You're not the POTUS, you're the BLOTUS. You're the glutton with the button. You're a regular gorge, Washington. You're the president.
Stephen Colbert there, and you said Saturday Night Live, also the beneficiary of this. So do you see this, Eric, as listeners wanting to see their point of view reflected, sort of, you know, how Facebook has been accused of being an echo chamber for people of similar points of view? Is that what you see happening? Or are people just wanting a guide through this super saturated news period that we're in?
Well, the first thing I would point out is that whenever someone from the general public complains about a broadcast, the FCC has to look into it. So that doesn't necessarily mean that Colbert is getting any extra scrutiny. It just means that he said something that prompted enough complaints from viewers that the FCC has to do what is not a particularly unusual sort of review of what he said to make sure it doesn't violate their guidelines, which are really about saying things that involve bodily functions and stuff like that. So I don't think he's in any danger, and I also don't think this review really means much. But beyond that, I've always had this pet theory that different kinds of media platforms attract people who might have different political persuasions. So it seems like the late night comedy audience is predominantly liberal, because the only shows that seem to do well in that space are shows that advocate sort of an openly liberal point of view. I would say talk radio is a space, for example, where conservative thought does really well. That's why Rush Limbaugh is there. That's why Sean Hannity is there. That's why Michael Savage is there. So I would say part of this is that the space is already dominated by liberals. But I also think part of this, as I said before, is that people are wanting to keep up with what's going on, and they're wanting to process it. So we look at the ratings for Fox News, for example. Fox News's ratings have also gone down a bit. I mean, they've gone up, but they haven't gone up as much as their competitors, CNN and MSNBC, especially recently. And recently, Fox News has really not talked about the news of the day that much, because it's so detrimental to the prospects of Donald Trump, and they're very openly advocating for him these days. So people are tuning to Fox News. Even regular viewers of Fox News are tuning in to find out what happened in the Comey investigation, or find out when he's going to testify before Congress, or find out what's going on with the latest allegations about what Trump may or may not have said about Israel providing intelligence that was revealed to the Russians. And if Fox isn't talking about it, then those viewers wind up going somewhere else to find out about that information. It doesn't necessarily mean that they're liberal. It means they want the information, and the source that they normally turn to is maybe not talking about it. So I would be careful about making too many generalizations about the political allegiances of the audience. I think it's I think some of that is happening, but I think some of this is also just about people trying to get a sense that they're getting a fair analysis of what's going on, and also that people are talking about what they're concerned about. And if they're not talking about what they're concerned about, they're going to turn to a place where that discussion is happening, even if it's a place where they might not totally agree with the political outlook of the person who's guiding the discussion.
We're talking to Eric Deggans right now about the rise of political TV. He's a TV critic for NPR. And let's take a call now. We've got Chris joining us in Sun Prairie. Chris, hi.
Hey, great topic. And I got to say, you know, I liked TV before the election, and it was interesting to see the differences between the broadcasts. But I went back to my old routine. I listened to Morning Edition on the way to work. I listened to Rush Limbaugh on lunch and Central Time on my way home. That's all the in-depth information I need, and I can process and filter out the gunk from both sides in that routine.
Chris, thanks a lot for that. Chris has a routine there that he's got. He's sticking to it. It sounds like it was all radio. He's not doing a lot of TV, but it does make you wonder, though, if we might be getting to a burnout point at some point. Do you see that happening, Eric, where people are less interested?
Well, I don't know. I think people would get less interested if things didn't keep happening. But we saw last week, I mean, you know, so many things were happening so quickly, so many revelations, so many bombshell reports, that to keep up with it, you really do have to engage with some sort of media outlet just to make sure that you know what's going on, if you want to stay informed. I mean, the twists and turns that the allegations against the Trump administration about, you know, the investigation into the campaign's possible ties to Russian interference, like, that has taken so many twists and turns over the past week that if you wanted to stay even moderately informed, you had to at least engage with some media outlet once a day just to download what might have happened. I would urge people... I'm urging people at this moment, and I'm sort of going beyond, you know, the moment where we have so much news happening. I'm urging people to broaden their media diet more and to also step back a little bit from the more contentious and conflict-laden platforms that are out there, specifically cable news and specifically social media. These are platforms that sort of thrive on conflict. And so after a few hours of watching CNN or Fox News or, you know, debating people on Twitter or Facebook, you can be very upset. It can unsettle you quite a bit, and it can make you feel as if the times maybe are worse than they actually are. So I think the key now is for people to learn how to moderate the media that they're taking in and be careful about watching this stuff too much. Because there's so many changing stories and there's so many breaking stories that it's seductive. You know, it's very tempting to just turn on CNN and constantly watch it and constantly react to every fresh news story that pops up.
We're talking now with Eric Deggans. He stays with us. He's a TV critic for NPR. And we're looking at sort of the heyday that we're seeing right now for political TV from shows like The Rachel Maddow Show. Fox News has had ratings go up. Eric says they've been modulating a little bit since then. We're also seeing Saturday Night Live, seeing a golden era. And we want to know about you. Are you watching more political TV? Are you seeking it out? And what do you like? Is it informing your point of view? Is it helping you make a decision, or is it just entertaining you, or maybe entertainment plus politics? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page, and we'll pick up our conversation in just a little bit. Stay with us here on Central Time.
What I have here is a copy of Donald Trump's tax returns. We have his federal tax return for 1 year, for 2005. I believe this is the only set of the president's federal taxes that reporters have ever gotten a hold of. What we have are these two pages, front and back, from the same 1040 form that you might have filled out when you file your taxes. And in terms of what's on here, let me give you the basics. Aside from the numbers being large, these pages are straightforward.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. Eric Deggans is with us from NPR, where he's the TV critic. And we're talking about the growing popularity of political TV, TV like the Rachel Maddow Show. We just heard a clip from one of her highest watched shows. And we want to hear from you on this. Are you doing more of this? Are you watching more of this sort of old-fashioned appointment TV, maybe cable news, Saturday Night Live, Fox News? And are you watching for solidarity or information? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. And let's take a caller now. We've got James joining us from Linden Station. James, hi.
Hi. I was just wondering, for your guest, what he thought about millennials viewing media and TV, because I have a lot of peers that, and myself, that don't think they view TV in the traditional sense. We kind of go on websites and view, I guess, kind of what we want, but we also stay informed with more neutral websites instead of kind of biased like Fox or CNN.
And so, James, let me ask you. So it sounds like you're still doing your internet thing. You're not switching over to TV. Is that right?
I do every once in a while, but it's more what I've noticed that, like, in at university and colleges, that a lot of people, a lot of my peers and students don't really traditionally get cable anymore, that they usually stick to internet. So with that, I feel it's less of the surfing and the full watching of the 24-hour networks and just viewing clips.
James, thanks a lot for that call. And James is a millennial, and he wants to know what other millennials are doing. Are they surfing, or are they also tuning into broadcast TV?
Well, I was interested in asking him. He talked about nonpartisan websites that he feels like his contemporaries are consulting, and I'd be interested in learning what they are, because I'm not so sure that people are all that great at discerning what the political leanings are of the websites that they're consulting. And, you know, I do a lot of speaking at colleges, and one of the things I'm always telling students is click the link. You know, when you see something on Twitter, you see something on Facebook, you see something on another platform, perhaps Instagram or Snapchat, you know, don't just take the headline at face value. Click the link and find out where the story came from. And that will give you a sense of maybe the motives of the platform in presenting that story to you the way they have presented it. I don't think enough people do that, and I think they often feel like they're getting news from a source like, quote-unquote, Facebook, when really they're getting it from a highly partisan news site that, frankly, may just be partisan because it's a money-making venture, and it's a way to monetize clickbait stories. My sense is that there's a lot of millennials who wait until a moment becomes a viral video, and then they'll consume it. So Stephen Colbert does something outrageous, and then it becomes a viral video, and then it will reach them later. They won't see it when it happens. They won't watch the show in its entirety. They'll wait until that clip is distributed on other social media platforms, and then they'll consume that. And maybe they'll get the context of what he was doing, and maybe they won't. That's the problem and the challenge, I think, for reaching millennials, is that a lot of times their media consumption is these flashes of media moments that break through the clutter for one reason or another, but you don't necessarily get the context that comes with them. And that's always been my concern. But I've also seen, particularly with people in college, kids in college, students in college, they are the children of their parents. So they will take the political ideologies that they've learned in their neighborhoods, in their homes, and bring them to college often. So even though there may be some sense that these students are trying to find new ways of consuming media, they are doing it with sort of a political worldview that's been shaped by their parents and in their home.
Well, James, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate that. And let's move on next to Judy in Bayside. Judy, hi.
Hi. I'm so glad to listen to this particular subject matter because I felt like I am the only one that spends my evening watching all three channels, the CNN, MSNBC, and Fox News, and I flip back and forth, but lately there's nothing to watch on Fox. They're just not, don't seem to be addressing any of Donald Trump's issues. And, I just can't understand why if they have a point of view. I don't understand why they aren't expressing it.
So, Judy, why are you flipping, Judy, because you want to make sure you get diverse perspectives? Is that?
Well, yes. I am a liberal, okay, but most of the things that are going on are so shocking to me that, I want to find out, is MSNBC exaggerating some of this stuff? I flip over to the other stations to see if, they're saying the same thing. And in many cases, Fox is not saying anything, and CNN is kind of saying some of the same things, but not quite as as much enthusiasm as MSNBC.
Judy, thanks so much for that comment. And Eric, I bet you'll tell Judy to get off the cable TV and start trying some new stuff.
Yeah, I would definitely say that. But just in terms of what Fox is doing, their position in a lot of their opinion shows especially has been to maintain that the stories that are most damaging to Donald Trump don't matter. And what matters is that the information behind the stories was leaked, classified information possibly, may have been leaked to reporters, and that what's important is finding out who is giving this information to journalists so that the White House can stop this unethical leaking. And I think, unfortunately, that position puts them in a situation where they don't really talk about the substance of the stories very much because they're trying to invalidate them. And this tactic, frankly, has kind of surprised me. And I would dare say, I would hazard a guess, I've been watching Fox News for years. If Roger Ailes, the founder of the channel, who recently passed away on Thursday, if he was running Fox News, he never made that mistake of ignoring news that the viewers thought was important. He always found a way to take the news that was in the news cycle and transform it in some way, spin it in some way, so that it would serve the interests of his conservative viewership. And that's a lot different than ignoring the news or trying to pretend it's not happening.
Well, Judy,
I also think Fox News is handicapped by the fact that President Trump has on several occasions gone out and verified parts of the story. Most recently, he is sort of in a backhanded way admitted that the intelligence that he revealed to the Russians came from Israel, which was a big part of the story that was broken last week that advanced this whole question of what did he say to the Russian ambassadors when he met with them in the Oval Office. So part of Fox's problem is that the president keeps confirming parts of these stories that they are trying to say don't matter. But the other part is that they, for some reason, have walked away from this this expertise that they had, this ability to spin a story that might be damaging to Republicans, but still talk about the substance of the story so their viewers would stay with them.
Eric, thanks a lot for joining us today. Really appreciate your time and your thoughts.
All right. Thank you for having me.
That was Eric Deggans, TV critic at NPR and the author of the book Race Baiter, How the Media Wields Dangerous Words to Divide a Nation. He joined us to talk about the rise of political TV like The Rachel Maddow Show, MSNBC, and Fox News. And we want to know what you think. Are you watching more political TV? Let us know on the Central Time Facebook page. Back in the day, Twin Peaks was the talked-about TV show. Nobody knew exactly what was happening, but it was eerie, and it was compelling in a very David Lynch kind of way. Well, now the show is back on TV, picking up the saga in a brooding Northwestern town. And Showtime is airing the revival of Twin Peaks. And David Lynch himself is back at the helm. And here's a little bit from the show with Special Agent Dale Cooper, lover of cherry pie, offering some sage advice to Sheriff Harry S. Truman.
Harry, I'm going to let you in on a little secret. Every day, once a day, give yourself a present. Don't plan it. Don't wait for it. Just let it happen. It could be a new shirt at the men's store, a cat nap in your office chair, or two cups of good, hot, black coffee. Like this.
A present. Like Christmas.
Now, so far, reviews are good. Critics are saying it's riveting, horrifying, stubbornly itself, a mix of TV and film. Some also said slow, but about what you'd expect and maybe you'd want from David Lynch. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert on the Ideas Network.